WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. World War II got us out of the Depression, but what effect will the Gulf War have on today's recession? My guest is economist Robert Kuttner. Kuttner is economics correspondent for The New Republic and a columnist for Business Week and the Boston Globe. He co-founded the liberal quarterly The American Prospect, and he served as chief investigator of the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs. Kuttner is the author of a new book about the global economy in the post-Cold War era. It's called The End of Laissez-Faire. I spoke with him this morning and asked him how World War II helped the economy recover from the Depression.
World War II was a totally different kind of effort. The economy as a whole was mobilized for war. At one point, we were spending close to half the gross national product on the war. We also had wage and price controls. We had a surtax on high incomes. We had coerced savings, as it were, through the war bonds program. We had the Federal Reserve entering into an agreement with the executive branch to finance the debt of the government at very low interest rates. So it was as close to a command economy as the United States has ever been. And in addition, it served as an extraordinary public works program. You had close to 10 million men and women working for the military. You also had people working in defense plants. All of the slack in the economy that had accumulated during the Great Depression was mobilized for war. And the effect, the stimulus on the economy was so potent that by 1945, when the war was over, the civilian part of the economy had increased by 50%, never mind how much of it had all gone up in smoke. So this was a total mobilization. The current war is spending at the rate of, say, $100 billion a year. That's 2% of gross national product, and much of the war is an inventory war. We're shooting off the weapons that we stockpiled during the Cold War, so it has very little stimulative effect on the economy, and moreover, we don't have wage and price controls, so that the little stimulus you do get leads to some inflationary pressures that the government is not counteracting, nor is the government taking any special measures to pay for the war. So you kind of end up with the worst of both worlds. You're not getting the stimulus, and you may get some inflationary pressures.
Alan Greenspan, the chair of the Fed, says that an extended war would deepen the recession. How would it do that?
Well, it would do it in a number of respects. First of all, the war depresses consumer confidence. And the timing of this war was such that it came about just as the economy was slipping into recession anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So if people were putting off the purchase of a new car or some other consumer durable, the war led them to think three times if they were already thinking twice about making that purchase. The other thing is that if the war is prolonged, the price of oil shoots right back up. The oil prices have come down, in part because futures markets think the war is going to be over soon, in part because we've persuaded our friends to pump more oil. But oil prices are very volatile, and a prolonged war would send them skyrocketing again. Also, we have this accumulated deficit, and the war is on budget for purposes of incurring deficits, but it's off budget for purposes of Graham-Rudman. It doesn't count in the Graham-Rudman calculations. And the longer the war goes on, the more we keep piling on deficits, which were already excessive.
The headlines in today's newspapers are baffling. On the business pages, the business page of the New York Times, you know, in the business section, there's an article on Sears and Roebuck eliminating 9,000 jobs, U.S. Air cutting back 3,585 jobs. And at the same time, the stock market is soaring. The Dow Jones average was up 71.54 yesterday. The
right.
Dow is up 15% since the war began. Can you explain?
It really is astonishing.
Yeah, can you explain why, in a time of so many layoffs, how Wall Street is soaring like that?
Well, let me explain it a few different ways. The stock market is a terrible indicator of the real economy. People invest in stocks based on their expectations of what other investors are going to do. Now, a couple of factors explain why the stock market is going up for the moment, but that should not be taken as a sign of health of the real economy. In fact, I would not be surprised if there were a fairly severe, I guess the euphemism is correction. You can't say crash anymore. What happened was this. The stock market 6 months ago was reacting to higher oil prices and to the beginning of a recession. So the stock market dropped several hundred points. Subsequently, the Federal Reserve has cut interest rates. Now, when interest rates drop, bonds become a less desirable investment and stocks become a more desirable investment. Investors then anticipate the behavior of other investors. The herd instinct takes over. People expect that money is going to pour out of bonds into stocks, and everybody wants to get in on the act. Then the price of oil drops faster than a lot of people thought, so that you have a kind of short-term bull market phenomenon in which everybody wants to get in on the action before it peaks, and that psychology pushes the market up. Meanwhile, as you suggest on the business page, the real economy is going down the drain. And the stock market going up is not in any way likely to help the real economy. The real economy is in trouble for a whole independent set of reasons. So I think the stock market boom is a short run, it's ephemeral, and it is not by any means a sign of economic health.
Robert Kuttner is my guest, and he's economic correspondent for The New Republic. He's a columnist for Business Week and the Boston Globe. And he's the author of a new book called The End of Laissez-Faire, National Purpose and the Global Economy After the Cold War. Something else that really confuses me right now, the United States is very much in debt, yet we're involved in a very expensive war. The Wall Street Journal recently estimated the cost of the war at $600 million a day, with the possibility of the cost rising as high as $2 billion a day in a ground war. Now, I know that the Allies are contributing a lot of money to the war. The United States is hardly having to foot this single-handedly. But still, the costs for the United States are quite high. Where exactly do we get the money from to pay for the war when we're as in debt as we are? Where does the money come from?
Well, we borrow more money. We borrow some of it from our own selves, our own citizens, and we borrow some of it from abroad. And it's remarkable how right-thinking people can be worried about the level of debt, the level of deficit spending, which is almost universally held to be too high, and held to be the reason why we can't spend money on things that most Americans want. Everything from public infrastructure to health care to child care and the rest of the laundry list, and all of a sudden a perceived threat to the national security comes along, and all those qualms are put on the shelf because a war is something that you simply have to do if the leaders define it as a sufficiently severe threat. So we simply borrow more money.
And that means that the debt goes up higher.
Sure. I mean, the debt is nothing but the accumulated total of past borrowings, and it also means that the current deficit goes higher. And all of Congress's efforts with the president last year to strike a budget deal have already been overtaken by events. The 40 or so billion dollar savings that Congress and the president were able to agree on for this fiscal year has already been swamped by the cost of the war. The fact that it is spending for national security purposes doesn't change the economic impact of it. If the deficit was too high at $200 billion, it's that much more too high at $300 billion. And of course, since a good portion of this is borrowed from abroad, that makes it even more serious because it limits the Federal Reserve's ability to fight recession by lowering interest rates. If you are trying to coax money into the United States from Japanese investors or German investors who can put their money into their own bonds, which pay equal or higher interest rates and which don't have the same risk of currency depreciation that a dollar investment does from the point of view of a Japanese investor or a German investor. The result is that the Federal Reserve has to put up interest rates higher than it otherwise would like to. That's the real long-term cost of all of this foreign borrowing, and that makes it harder to fight the recession. It makes it more expensive to finance the existing debt, and it makes it more expensive to pay for the costs of the war. So the war compounds the pickle that the economy is already in.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Kuttner, and he's the economic correspondent for The New Republic, a columnist for Business Week and the Boston Globe, and the author of a new book called The End of Laissez-Faire. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Economist Robert Kuttner is my guest. He's the author of a new book called The End of Laissez-Faire, National Purpose and the Global Economy After the Cold War. Let me quote something that Senator Edward Kennedy recently said. He said, if we can spend so much money defending the throne of the Emir of Kuwait, why can't we do something to defend the jobs of American workers? Now, is the money that we're spending on the war money that we would otherwise be using at home to create new jobs or for health care or social welfare? Or are the two, when it comes down to it, pretty unrelated in terms of where the money's coming from?
Well, you're really posing a political question, Terry. If senators and congressmen had stepped forward and said, the country is facing a severe domestic crisis, living standards for 80% of families have stagnated or declined, our infrastructure is a ruin, our civilian research and development investments are not keeping pace with those of our competitors, we need to spend $100 billion a year to get the country's economy in order, that would not have commanded majority support in the Congress, nor would the administration have supported it. But somehow, money can always be found to fight a war. So I don't think you could say as a political matter that if we had not fought this war, that money would have been spent on other good things. It doesn't mean it shouldn't have been spent. It means that it's very difficult politics. The other way in which spending for war constrains what we can do at home is that it eats up the peace dividend. When the Cold War ended, there was a great deal of hope that the spending that had gone for the military, based on our assumptions about the East-West conflict, could now be reduced and could now be spent for domestic needs. Obviously, this new perceived threat in the Middle East is going to mean a relatively larger military, and it's going to increase the deficit in a way that constrains the ability of Congress to spend any new money on civilian needs that it might have targeted with a peace dividend mood or a peace dividend psychology. So not only does it consume money that otherwise might have been available for domestic spending, but it creates both a psychology and a budgetary reality in which you can't even think about spending money on civilian needs.
You've looked at the budget President Bush submitted for 1992. How do you think domestic issues will fare in that budget? And I'm wondering if you see the results of the borrowing that America has to do to pay for the Gulf War, if you see the results of that in the way the 1992 budget plays out.
Well, I think it drastically constrains the ability of the president or the Congress to spend money on anything domestic. You have a kind of shell game going on where he's shifting money from one account to another account, but domestic spending is not really keeping pace with inflation. You have the debt going up, which means that interest costs go up, and that eats into the government's ability to spend money on other things. So clearly the war has a tremendous effect both on the balance sheet and on the psychology and the politics.
The savings and loan crisis added to America's financial problems. How worried are you about the commercial banks now? Do you envision a commercial bank crisis in the future?
I'm very worried about the commercial banks. I think the banks find themselves in a really unprecedented squeeze, certainly unprecedented since the Great Depression. And I don't think the administration has a clear sense of how to fix it. My worry is that they're going to try and fix it the same way they tried to fix the savings and loans 10 years ago with the same kind of result. The banks got into difficulty because in the 1970s, when you had the beginning of deregulation, you had money market mutual funds competing with banks for the savers' dollar. You had Wall Street and the so-called commercial paper market, which means the ability of corporations to borrow directly from the public, competing with the bank's traditional lending customers. As a result, banks got themselves more heavily into high-risk lending. They got more involved in third-world loans. they got more involved in junk bond deals, and they got more involved in real estate as a way of compensating for the fact that the traditional bread and butter business that they had enjoyed previously was drying up. And when the real estate market started getting soft, when the third world loans turned bad, the bank's balance sheets deteriorated. That is, they found themselves with more bad loans and less earnings. And the administration somehow thinks that if you let banks become more speculative, that will make them more profitable. And of course, this was exactly what happened with the savings and loan crisis. Savings and loans, in line with the prevailing vogue for deregulation, were allowed to become more speculative in where they put, I started to say where they put their money, where they put other people's money, and they were allowed to become more entrepreneurial in bidding for money. They were bidding against each other to see who could pay the highest interest rates. Given the fact that they were having to pay high interest rates to attract money, they then had to become more speculative in where they invested that money, and the result was the savings and loan meltdown.
I'm going to ask you to take everything that you've told us and kind of bring it down to a very practical level. Do you think that we're in for difficult economic times in the near future?
Yes, I think we're in for terrible economic times. And the reason is that the normal tools that the government has to get us out of recession are not available. We can't use very low interest rates. We can't use deficit spending. And on top of that, we have a very shaky banking sector. And I think if the war ends quickly, that will enable us to refocus on the economy that much more quickly, but it won't solve the economic problems because the fundamental problems of the economy were not caused by the war, and they won't be cured by a quick end of the war. If the war goes on for a longer time, it will only make the economic situation that much worse. And I think in addition to the fact that the real economy is in trouble, you also have a misguided set of assumptions about what to do about it. You have a continuation of the same ideology that prevailed in the early 1980s, which insisted that the only things ailing the economy were that it was too regulated, that the government loomed too large, and that the cure was to deregulate everything, privatize everything, get the government off everybody's back. Well, we saw the result of that. The result of that was a decade of deferral, in which the real national debt doubled, in which the banking sector got shaky, and none of it bore the kind of fruit that was promised. And yet the same kinds of people are still making the same kinds of policies. You have a kinder, gentler version of the rhetoric under George Bush than you did under Ronald Reagan, but the same philosophy reigns.
Robert Kuttner, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us today. Thank you for your time.
Nice to be with you.
Economist Robert Kuttner, he's written a new book called The End of Laissez-Faire about the global economy in the new post-Cold War era. That will be the subject of a future interview.